Gresham College presents Medical Advance, Its Global Challenge by Professor Sir Kenneth Stewart, MD, FRCP.
Good morning to you. In my last two lectures, you remember I covered the issues that seemed to me to stem, the important issues that seemed to me to stem from today's scientific medical advances. Many of these issues, you'll recall, I pointed out that although they might have medical implications, they cannot be left exclusively to doctors to resolve. Although they have legal implications, they cannot be left entirely to lawyers to determine. And although they have scientific implications, they cannot be left entirely to scientists. What we need to do is to construct mechanism and instruments whereby society as a whole and the various groups that comprise our society have the opportunity to understand, to discuss, to reflect on, and make their own recommendations about these complex issues. It is unrealistic to leave them to any one group, no matter how learned that special group might be. And this, I think, is the biggest single dilemma that confronts today's societies. We haven't yet evolve such mechanisms. I am a doctor, and my medical legal groups talk to doctors. I know that the lawyers have similar ethical bodies. They talk to lawyers, and so do the scientists. So do the attorneys and what have you. And unless and until society can arrive at and arrange a mechanism whereby there can be this interdisciplinary discourse, we are not going to be able to deal with any of today's, or certainly the major of today's, complex issues. No major societal problem is thrown up in dollops whereby the lawyers can solve that problem, the doctors can solve that problem. This is not the way society, our complex society, is emerging. The critical question, therefore, is how can the requisite interdisciplinary discussion and action be generated in today's complex societies? How can the wide range of beliefs and social groups of which countries are comprised be represented in the formulation of community judgments? Constrained as they are by structures and policies designed for earlier, simpler times, and in the face of the intensifying complexity and often confrontational nature of so many of today's emerging issues, those who have the responsibility for leadership in contemporary societies are confronted by formidable obstacles. And it is because societies themselves differ so widely and have such profoundly different cultural perspectives and moral values that universal solutions to any major issue are so difficult to come by. Between the universal nature of the problems and the infinite variety of groups that must offer solutions for them, we have one of the persisting dilemmas of the legal, medical, and ethical handling of biomedical issues today. But each society must seek its own solution, its own way forward, and whatever the issue and whatever the nature of the society, an informed and involved public is essential if it is going to be able to anticipate and address the problems of a fundamental nature which might not yet even have appeared on the horizon. To define priorities, to tap its own resources of understanding and vision, to mobilize its own moral and intellectual capabilities in a culturally holistic fashion, to define and to vigorously defend its own interests and values. Wide international attention has now been focused on the need for global action to halt the degradation of the physical environment. But this is only one of the indicators, in my view, of the need for such international action. Degradation of the global intellectual environment can be just as imperceptible and insidious, and can be just as threatening in the long run if nothing is done about it. An ozone layer of the intellect is as important as its physical counterpart, and will be as important a determinant of the quality of life we live in our one world. The 1980 report of the North-South Commission, chaired by Willy Brandt, the former Chancellor of West Germany, repeatedly stressed its cardinal premise that the survival of mankind is a global challenge, an imperative powerful enough to create a bond of global solidarity. We remain uncertain, indeed even doubtful, about the extent of our moral imperative to work for the survival of others, to appreciate that everyone in the world has a claim to everyone else, that one has obligations to provide not only for the well-being of one's own children, for example, but for the children of others as well. This need for a lingua franca of global social concern extends to the wider values that stem from medical scientific advance. And here also, the role of the media is pivotal. Our contemporary societies have, of course, recognized and addressed such issues from time to time. And the questions that you may well ask are, have there been any lessons for us from these past efforts? What can now be done that hasn't been done before? What is now proposed that hasn't been proposed before? Admittedly, much has been done, but its history has been one of dismal inadequacy. Too little and too late. Actions taken have been, for the most part, episodic in time, too fragmentary in scope, too unfocused in direction, too limited in objectives, too disparate and too randomly dispersed, both within and between countries, to achieve the critical mass and momentum that would be needed for coordinated and sustainable national, not to mention international, initiatives. There is now, for instance, in Britain alone, not to mention those in North America and Europe, a long list of organizations concerned with medical and other professional ethical issues who hardly know of each other's existence, far less their concerns, or how to collaborate on them. It is the legal aspects of issues related to medical scientific advance that have been most commonly singled out for action. And legal solutions are what are most commonly proffered. Legal judgments, for example, were made in Britain not so very long ago about the disposal of babies of surrogate mothers, and more recently about the sterilization of a mentally retarded minor, and about abortion on a mentally handicapped adult. Now, it is not so much the content of these judgments as the manner in which they were reached that should be a matter, and certainly for me is a matter, of concern. Both dealt with issues to which, by their very nature, women must have more to contribute than medical or legal professionals, and yet, whether in the formulation or interpretation of the relevant legal codes, or in the political and social debate on which such codes should be based, the voices of women are hardly audible. In Britain, such issues commonly reach the appeal court of the House of Lords, and admittedly, members of this august body have been most effective social ombudsmen for several issues in the past, and have often been the last guardians of vital principles of justice. But there can be no logical reason, in my view, why, however learned in the law this august body might be, they would be better equipped than any other socially conscious and informed community group to provide quote-unquote correct answers to the questions asked. Reference of such questions to them, at best a social compromise, is in fact a capitulation of societal responsibility and reflects a complete lack of public appreciation of the nature of the problems involved. Legal judgments are not all that is needed, and when they are needed, they should be informed by more than a knowledge of the law. The law alone cannot maintain moral and social order. An intolerable burden would be placed on legal enforcement agencies if these had to operate without the support of custom, community, church, family, and school. Solzhenitsyn saw the fact that modern Western societies are extremely legalistic as a mark of their decadence. We expect the legal system to bear too much of the weight of what should be the responsibility of our societal traditions. If the values protected by law are to be truly safeguarded, they need to be protected by other forces in society as well. Now, at least two Commonwealth countries have recently adopted procedures which might provide useful guidelines for future action in relation to such issues. The approach by the Australian Law Reform Commission on the formulation of laws on human tissue transplantation a few years ago is an example of how a start might be made. This commission, under the chairmanship of the Honourable Justice Kirby, gathered a nucleus of interdisciplinary community expertise, including a moral philosopher and theologian, to identify the social and moral problems and solutions. Throughout the country, a series of public hearings were held in which the commissioners listened to ordinary citizens expressing their experiences and concerns. These hearings were accompanied by seminars with the medical profession and healthcare groups. Considerable press coverage, television and radio debate followed, so that few Australians cannot have known that their opinion was being sought. It was only then that a draft legal bill emerged. And then there's the lead given by the Canadian Law Reform Commission. Established in 1971 by the Law Reform Commission Act of Canada, the Canadian Law Reform Commission is a permanent body whose purpose is to keep the laws of Canada under continuing and systematic review, a process intended to complement the ongoing judicial and legislative processes. The Commission is intended to achieve these ends through extensive consultation with the public. The first chairman of the Commission, the Honourable Mr. Justice Hart, in a paraphrase of Lord Wilberforce, stressed the duty of dialogue with members of the public when he stated, and I quote, "The process of law reform is too important to be left to lawyers alone. Law touches the lives of everyone. It is therefore the business of everyone." End of quote. The advantage of legislation arrived at following public consultation is that it would be seen to reflect and not to attempt to dictate public opinion. It would enable communities to recognize the diversity of sincerely held points of view. It would also be a salutary experience for lawyers, doctors, legislators, and laymen to hear diverse views and to recognize the need for urgent, coordinated action. The permanent national multidisciplinary review body that I advocate would function, therefore, against a background of informed public opinion and discussion. Every country, developed or developing, that seeks to seriously address its national health issues should have such a body. It could both stimulate and be responsive to special community groups and institutions, community leaders, churches, the media, and the like. Measures for achieving this should be given the highest priority in any program of national action to be undertaken. But will countries have the foresight and the imagination it would take to respond appropriately to this need? And so I'm afraid that the question I would leave with you, ladies and gentlemen, is the one we started with. It is not only how medical practice, but how society itself will cope in the age of science and technology. The question that each of you might well ask is, what can I do to resolve these issues? What can I personally do to resolve these issues? My answer would be that it is what each of us does that matters. I could do no better than to quote for you the advice of Tom Berger, the former Chief Justice of the British Columbia Supreme Court. He said, "You may be few in number. You may not represent the public. But it is in the public interest that your voices be heard." I am sure somehow that this is what the Indian poet and philosopher Tagore meant when he said, "The few are more than the many." Thank you.
For all information, please visit www.gresham.ac.uk.